It's classic. Nancy Honeytree, of course, back then she went just by Honeytree. Now she's Nancy Honeytree Miller, still with us. Hope she's still singing, but this is a classic, Purify My Heart. It's 10 minutes after the hour. It's a Wednesday morning here along the Broken Road, and that means Doug Greenwald. This week it means Doug Greenwald because he was out fooling around someplace last week, and we didn't get to talk to him. It's rumored that he was in Arizona doing something constructive and very, very important. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow at Preserving Bible Times, the Executive Director thereof. Tell us, what was going on last week?
Well, first I wanted to, did you say constructive or destructive? I couldn't catch the enunciation clearly.
Well, sometimes I mumble.
And then you said he was fooling around.
Well, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, hey, when it's 100 degrees, you don't fool around outside too often.
Did you run into 100 degrees last week in Phoenix?
That was 100 degrees. 104 really? On the freeway, yeah.
Already? Oh, man.
But as they say, it's low humidity.
It's a dry heat, yeah.
Well, you know, and did you feel the difference in the humidity? You must have.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean,
you walk outside, which I did many times from the meeting rooms to my car to get things. You never sweat. Because as soon as a molecule of water gets on your skin, it evaporates.
Yeah, it dries out, yeah. In my high school days, I used to work at a Montgomery Ward store at Thomas Mall in Phoenix. I was in the paint department. And, of course, it was a nice air-conditioned store. And we'd have customers come in and say, well, I want to buy some paint. I want 16 gallons. Can you carry that out for me? And I'd go, well, sure, I'd be happy to. And so we'd put it on the cart, wheel it out through those doors, and hit that. Now, this was dead summer, so it's 110, 115. It was like walking into a brick wall. Boom.
Where the phrase come from, we'll choose up sides and watch paint dry?
Yeah, I think, yeah. Well, because you had to get up to the car quick before it evaporated, you know. You had to run out there and pour it in. So, yeah, I remember that Phoenix heat.
Did you notice the oven mitts in the cars out there?
Did you all those black interiors in cars, they sit out in the parking lot now, and they roast. So when you get in them, you can't touch the steering wheel.
No.
So a lot of people the keys. Cover the dashes.
You put the keys in the ignition, and you got to turn it over right away, because if you let the keys hang there for a little bit, all the heat from the engine compartment comes back up there because it wants to, you know, it seeks to level off the temperature.
And
15 seconds later, your keys are too hot to touch.
It always amazes me why people who live in hot climates buy black cars. I've never gotten that.
It's the cool thing to do, so to speak.
So to speak.
Maybe not.
I guess so.
Doug, tell us about it. The International Holistic Missions Convention. What is this organization?
Well, that's a good question. That was my first question when I heard about them.
I suppose.
Particularly because holistic is spelled with W-H, not H-O-L.
Yeah.
And that's intentional. They're trying to not be confused with Eastern holistic medicines, that's, you know, acupuncture and Tibetan massage and all that kind of thing. It's holistic, whole, meaning, and this is one of their mottos, the whole church on mission. Every day. And that's in contrast to many a church where four or five, maybe six people operate the missions committee as their personal fiefdom, and the rest of the church has really no idea what's going on. So I mean, that's not the whole church on mission. That's a handful of people paying attention to a mission budget. So that's sort of observation number one, which is kind of refreshing. The other thing is they take the phrase love your neighbor from Jesus, very biblical, and say that means serve my neighbor. And it means serve my neighbor in every aspect of his life or her life. Now that's an interesting thought right there. The way this translates internationally is into something called Che, not Che Guevara, but C-H-E, which is Community Health Evangelism. And I didn't know what that meant either. I thought health meant medical, but no, it means the complete health of the organic community. You know, it's social life, it's physical life, it's sanitation life, it's the water systems. Everything about the community is the whole community. And so when you marry those two thoughts together, that loving your neighbor is serving your neighbor in every aspect of his or her life. If you love a community, you serve the community in every aspect of its life. And so the strategy of Che, which is a pretty big movement, I mean, was unknown to me, but that's just because I live in my Bible and context cocoon world here, I guess. Numbers of NGO mission type organizations are Che organizations. And what they do is they walk into the third world, into, or say, a rural village setting, and they've learned not to show up with money and not to show up with resources, because that easily leads to gaming the system on the part of the indigenous people. And they start to make relationships, and they have a template in mind that they sort of evaluate the village in all sorts of very, very common areas. You know, are there gardens? Is there sewage handling? Is there water? Would they benefit from natural gas? Where do the women wash the village's clothes? How far away do they have to walk to do that? I mean, all that sort of practical kind of thing. Because they're looking at what one or two things can be done in this village that will have a pretty immediate impact in terms of improving the overall quality of health in that village. And if there are churches in the area, as is often the case in Latin America, their vision is to work through the churches, the local indigenous churches, not to go around them and not to go direct with what we'd call hands-on being a missionary.
You don't short-circuit the local church then.
Exactly, yeah. Because they're convinced and committed to the fact that the church is the body of Christ here on earth, and we need to make that as vital and vibrant as possible, and hence, you know, their vision, the whole church on mission. And that means the indigenous church as well, not just the North American church. And so a lot of their efforts are just to get the churches to talk to each other. And not surprising, churches are parochial in the third world and in rural villages, just like they are in the United States. Getting churches to cooperate can sometimes take a lot of effort and exhortation and creativity. But then they get the leaders from those churches together to come to a common consensus about, you know, what would need to be fixed. So, for example, I'm talking to a coordinator from Honduras. And in Honduras, they have lots of spring floods. Some years are just awful. And they had just epic floods about 10 years ago. And it washed out the cement pad in the village that was right alongside the river there, where the women washed their clothes. And for whatever reason, that cement pad was never replaced. And so the women would walk 2 hours every day downriver to another village where they had a cement pad, and they would wash their clothes. So they quickly devised that this would be a good thing to do, and they worked through the churches and got them mobilized, and together they put the cement pad back in place. Now, I think the mission organization probably brought in the concrete or paid for the concrete. There are some things that they will do, but only after the community has been mobilized. And then, as a part of this, as they're working with the people, they begin to tell stories, and their Bible stories. Because, and I guess I knew this at one level, but never really connected with it at another level, 75% of the world are oral and symbol-based cultures. They're not literary cultures. They don't read books. They memorize stories and pass along stories. And so these missionaries, if we can call them that, start to tell Old Testament stories about David and creation and Jesus stories. And these oral cultures just absolutely love stories. And these are really good Bible stories. And so before you know it, these Bible stories are being passed along all throughout the networks of the clans and the villages. No one's called this Christianity at this point. They just know it's a great story. And embedded in these stories are moral observations, moral precepts, which the villagers begin to embrace. And this leads to a whole notion called discipling before conversion. And as I stopped and thought about it, that's exactly what Jesus did. I mean, this is a mega thought from 30,000 feet as pertains to biblical context. Jesus was discipling the disciples long before they became converted.
I'm letting that soak in. I'm trying to, and I can see it. I can see it.
And so that's the strategy that they embrace in these third world situations. And particularly when they get into Muslim cultures, they tell Bible stories and Jesus stories, but they never, quote, they never use the word Christianity. Okay. And it's just another great story. And of course, Islam considers Jesus a prophet. So, you know, it sort of fits. It's just really, really intriguing. So that's one thing I learned.
Now, are they invited to these places generally?
They sort of invite themselves into these places.
Okay.
And it's really interesting. They sort of walk into the village, introduce themselves, start to make relationships. And what they're looking for is what they call a person of peace. And in our lingo, we would probably use the word champion. They're looking for a champion. Someone who really loves the village, who has a heart for the village, has a heart for serving, and has a very pleasant spirit about them that they feel they can work with. Because they'll create a relationship with this person of peace and share the vision with him, and then he'll take it to the rest of the village. And after spending a little time in a village, if they can't sense there is a person of peace, they move on to another village. And I can really relate to this, because at Preserving Bible Times, if there's not a champion inside a church that takes the banner and said, we want Preserving Bible Times to come to our church to bring some of their Bible in Context multimedia seminars, it never happens. You have to have a champion inside a church, or a church is just basically never going to invite you in. They don't know who you are. You're a stranger, so why should they pay any attention? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think this thing is sort of universal. But I thought that was interesting as well, how they have a very definite, call it template in view as to how what they're looking for, how they engage a culture, a village, to size it up, whether this is a good prospect ultimately for the gospel.
So this was a conference of organizations who work like that. It wasn't one,
yeah, like-minded.
Single.
Okay. Well, yeah. This it was an interesting fusion of things. People from all around the world who are involved in these Che type ministries, these Che type organizations, came together. Mm-hmm. But lots of people from churches in the United States came together who are interested in this kind of missions approach and who are interested in trying to mobilize their own church in the United States to engage their community.
Hmm.
The whole church on mission every day. And so it's probably one-third pastors, one-third NGO mission types, leadership type people, and one-third people from the pew who are intrigued with missions for whatever reason or are involved with missions committees, that kind of thing. That was sort of the fusion of people there. And I had lunch. I had a wonderful lunch, serendipitous lunch, with a couple named Anna and Nam Ho. Nam is Vietnamese. Anna is an English lady who married Nam about 10 years ago. And their vision is this. They walk into a very, very poor, poverty-laden rural village in Vietnam. So this couple, you know, they're probably 40 now. They've been doing this about 10 years. Their vision is a Shea-related division, except they're going to get around much more quickly to dealing with worldview issues, not just telling Jesus stories or Old Testament stories about God and creation. And at the same time, they're sizing the village up as to what can we do. So they targeted five really, really poor, poverty-stricken villages for a multi-year project. And they walked in to the first one, and of course, rice growing is a big deal in Vietnam, and found out that about only a third of the fields were being worked. The other two-thirds were not being worked because of extreme alcoholism in the men in the village. They also found out that even a third of the rice crop each year, not more than half of that ever got to market because it was such a torturous two-mile path to get to a main road. And so they said, well, if we can deal with alcoholism and we can get a new road put in, this could really transform this village. And so they mobilized the leadership of the village. They found a person of peace, and they started to make those improvements. It took about a year for the men to get off alcohol and start paying attention to their fields again. It took them about 18 months to lay a new two-mile road in place that actually now a truck could come into the village. The yields started to go up, and in the third year, a modest drought hit the land, and water being absolutely necessary for rice growing. The people in the village, who now are believers in the sense that the worldview teaching, they go from God to Jesus to prayer to intercession, and just bring them in through discipling, they bring them into conversion. And they began to pray for water during this modest drought period. And one of the persons said, let's dig a well, which is not a particularly good idea, but the idea caught on. And so they started to dig in a certain place, and they only got down about 4 feet, and they just hit water. And the water was endless. You know, every time they'd bucket it out or channel it out somewhere, the water just kept coming. There's no explanation for it. There is no water table that high up in the land. And you can just see God at work doing miracles to encourage these embryonic believers to continue to put their faith in Him. Well, anyway, because suddenly now they had water, they had great yield in their fields. The rice price went up by a factor of 3 because in big blocks of the country, the rice yield was way down because of the drought. Trucks now could come into the village and pick up the rice and take it to market. And by the end of the third year, this was a very prosperous village, where 3 years before it had been incredibly poor. Okay, and they did this in four other villages. They actually have a track record of 5 villages where the turnaround from poverty to prosperity has taken place, bringing in the gospel of Jesus Christ, bringing in the full scripture in oral form, and serving people with a, you know, this sort of Che template that they go through. Well, this is what really gets interesting. The communist government got wind of this. 5 villages going from poverty to prosperity. How did that happen? So from Hanoi, they sent out the PhD social scientist types to study how in the world this happened. And they came back and they made their report to the communist leadership. And it was a simple report. The difference between poverty and prosperity is the Bible. And this sort of befuddled the communist leadership in Vietnam, being atheistic and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. They said, we want you to study something else. How can we slow down this Christian thing? So they went off on another study all around the country, and they came back, and this was their report. If you really want to slow down this Christian thing, have them build a church.
Oh, my goodness. Oh. My goodness.
He says, that'll suck up all the resources that they could use to help the community get better. Mm. And then they'll get in disagreements and arguments about what kind of church to build and how to maintain it. And it's a surefire formula. If you want to slow the church down, or the body of Christ down, have them build a church.
Build a church.
Yeah, where do we go with that here now? We could
well, as one guy said, this is a plenary speaker. He was really getting wound up about misplaced priorities in his view. And he said, where in the world did we ever get the paradigm to spend 85% of our resources for a 90-minute Sunday morning experience?
Well, I hope that conference was well attended. A lot of people there?
There were 550.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I don't know whether that's high, low, or indifferent. But this is an interesting notion. And the reason people were coming from around the United States from churches is to get a vision for this Che kind of thing and ask the question, how can we mobilize our North American churches where everybody's on mission, everybody is serving their neighbor in some way in every aspect of our neighbor's life? Because that's what seems to be transformative. Mm. Mm-hmm.
Now, is this organization, do they have a website? I say they.
I suspect they do. I just Googled the International Holistic Ministry Conference.
Okay.
And I think all of the PowerPoints from the presentations are going to be online. I know the two presentations I made are going to be online, my PowerPoints. And the reason I was there is because there's another controversy going on, not controversy, vigorous discussion. The Lausanne conference of 10 or 15 years ago, the worldwide meeting of Christian organizations, sort of came up and said that we have two priorities, evangelism and social justice. And there's a subset of evangelicalism that says, nope, that is wrongly stated. We're not here to do evangelism. We're here to make disciples. And so there's that sort of, as the British would say, controversy going on. And because the bulk of the people in the International Holistic Missions movement are committed to making disciples, not just to converts, that's how I ended up getting invited there.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm.
To talk about a biblical framework for making disciples, different perspectives on the same thing, and to also lead a second workshop on discipling wisdom. And so those are the 2 one-hour workshops that I led. And I was really gratified by the response of people. You know some of the material that I present, because I presented it up there in central Minnesota a couple months ago.
Yeah.
But it was a fresh perspective for almost everybody. They really hadn't thought those thoughts, hadn't seen it that way. And it was, for some, paradigm expanding, for others, paradigm changing. And I was positively taken back by that. I mean, here are the people on the front lines of some pretty impressive stuff, and yet they hadn't thought through all the implications of the process of making disciples and the biblical framework thereof. And so it was fun for me to be there to lead those two sessions, to share some thoughts, and to be involved in a lot of conversation with people before and after those particular workshops.
Well, I'm glad you reported back to us, because I was curious to begin with, and now this looks like something that I'd like to pursue. Well, we'll have a link. If I can find the link on a website, we'll make that part of the podcast. Excuse me, when we post this conversation on the website later this morning. But I'd like to know more about that organization and that whole approach to discipling, that this discipleship before conversion has lit a big light bulb over my head here. Can you see that, David?
Is this kind of mm-hmm. glowing? Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
The what you were describing, Doug, is the way the mission in Malawi is operated. And you know, I don't know if anybody thought that through ahead of time, but the mission over there in Africa has got its start from a number of the elders in a village around that particular area.
Now, this is the mission trip you were on, just so listeners are with us, from your local church here in this mm-hmm. area. It sent you over to Malawi last summer. It was last June, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was last June. Mm-hmm. And there was a group of elders in villages over there that noticed that there was a large number of orphans that were not being fed, not being cared for, and they began an orphan project. And they formed a group. They developed an NGO. Did the legal structure, and then they found a leader, a guy that happened to be a journalist at the time. He was out doing interviews with just people in the community, just people around the area, doing interviews that he would later on play back for his broadcast. And they picked him as they got to know him a little bit more, and then eventually they made him an offer, and would you lead this particular mission? Would you be the title head? And one of the things that, there's a lot of things that happened before that, but he became the champion you're talking about. Our church got involved about 7 years ago, and what we did is we dug them a well, and a well closer to the village. They'd been getting water about a 45-minute walk away, and only the women, of course, are allowed to carry jugs on their heads. I don't know if you knew that or not, but I tried. I fought like a tiger. I said, no, I want to carry water. Please, please. And they said, no. It's a woman's work. But the well now is a hand pump well. You don't have to get down on your knees next to the crocodiles and the critters, but you can just reach over and pump the water. And, has done all kinds of things. I've got first-hand experience in the things that you were talking about. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about was do you see the connection to free market capitalism in making this village prosperous? And is there a natural tie between free market capitalism and biblical teachings?
I'm not going to touch the latter subject, but certainly the rice paddy example I just gave you is all driven by supply and demand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what made the village prosperous. So yes and no. I mean, the example, the Honduran example that I gave you about putting a new cement pad where the old one got washed away 10 years before, so people can wash their clothes in their own village. That's just a service. I mean, that's not economics in any way, shape, form, or manner. And I think that's how you get started, and that's how the champion proves his worth, and that's how you establish relationships in the village. But yes, ultimately, if you're trying to raise the economic level of the village, it somehow has to tie into something you make and something you sell.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yes, you can improve the yields of your vegetable gardens and that sort of thing, but that was my sense. And so the things that they end up doing that have remarkable impact for very low investment, I just found fascinating. I saw a pressure vessel. That may not mean anything to you, but it's just a big tank. And it's a tank that can be completely closed. And what they had the people do was collect cow patties, from all mm-hmm. around the villages and the fields, and throw them in the tank. And probably it maybe threw a little alcohol in there, I'm not sure. And they started a fermentation process. And they could tell that methane gas was being created because there's a pressure gauge on the tank. And what they then did was took small pipes and piped it to each of the 22 huts in the village, and now they were all cooking with natural gas.
Mm.
Isn't that fascinating?
Wow.
Heretofore, they were always burning wood fire, and in some areas, you know, chronically cutting down trees for wood to make charcoal is not a good thing to do. And so I saw a picture of this lady squatting down, cooking her family's meal with natural gas.
Wow. Wow. What a vision.
Here's a thought that struck me as I was listening to all this. It's the word leverage. Mm. If I was in a missions committee in North America here in a church, I now have a different metric, a different yardstick about how I would think about missions. Let me do a compare and contrast here. I ran across one of these Che type related organizations called Harvest Foundation, one of the older ones, one of the more well-established ones. They have 43 people around the world working in 23 different countries to mobilize churches, to meet the needs of villages, and to bring the gospel to these villages. All 43 of these people who are field people for Harvest International are indigenous people, and they all have tent-making jobs. So, you know, you don't need to raise funds to pay their salaries.
Right.
The only reason that funds are raised is to help them with their traveling expenses and maybe to buy a cell phone or a laptop computer, that kind of thing, okay? And so you talk about getting a lot of miles per gallon from your investment in certain kinds of mission ministries. I realize that there are some that are getting tremendous leverage per dollar invested in them, in contrast to perhaps the old way, where we all band together to pay the salary of a North American missionary who goes to rural Africa and runs Bible studies, teaching them about Jesus. That's probably the lowest yield per dollar invested. Not much leverage at all. And so I was really fascinated how some of these really creative, very effective Che organizations have found ways to get a lot of miles per gallon from a dollar invested in their ministry.
Che, C-H-E, Community Health Evangelism.
Yep.
And you know what you've described in these projects to me is something you've taught us before. And to me, it sounds very much like do and teach. You do for people, and the teaching comes later.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Actually, it's do and teach at the same time almost, if you take the front end of just starting to share Bible stories with the people who are in oral cultures. Mm. And here's another observation, a statistic I never really heard before. 75% of our Bible is a story. 15% of it is poetry, and only 10% of it is teaching. And yet we focus on the teaching, the 10% part, so much here in North America, and they're focusing on the 75% here in these third world indigenous situations.
This was enlightening. Doug, as always, we're grateful that you brought back the story for us and taught us a few things today. You got to be busy getting back to your desk there in Columbia, Maryland, the Preserving Bible Time, so we'll let you go.
Well, just one more thing. The PowerPoints that I used, which were pretty extensive and elaborate for both of my presentations, A Biblical Framework for Making Disciples as well as Discipling Wisdom, are supposed to be up on the website here for the International Holistic Ministries Conference. And if people are interested, they can check them out.
All right. Well, then we'll attempt to find that link and then put that in the podcast so people can look and learn more about that particular organization. So, Doug, have a great week, okay? Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Then we'll see you next Wednesday. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow at Preserving Bible Times, their website, preservingbibletimes.org. You can link to it if you like, right there where you are now at Broken Road Radio. Doug, we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys. Shalom, shalom.
Shalom, Doug.